Good morning. I'm your host, Claudia Shambaugh. This is the May 17 edition, May 7th, 2013 edition of Ask a Leader. May 3rd, last Friday, was World Press Freedom Day, and you know what they say about community radio. Community radios are an essential component of a democratic free society as they provide access to diverse opinions and points of view. As I quote the Community Federation, and so in the words of the National Federation, we take this into ending the pledge drive of last week or two. The host of individuals and their stations who cobble together a great deal of programming on a shoestring, usually to give you what we think is so very important, ideas, perspectives, and flavors that you won't get anywhere else. I'll continue to keep up my end of the bargain, I assure you. I love it too much to let this opportunity go by you. Today, we have two local women who keep making good on valiant enterprises. Jeannie Meese returns with news from her Cradle to Career Kenya, a combination of two Newport Beach-based nonprofits, African Child Foundation and Agano with Kenya. Then we'll be treated to a deepening cultural appreciation with art maven Phyllis Luchin. So please don't go away. We'll be right back after a very short interlude. Welcome back to the show. I told you it was going to be short. My first guest today is Jeannie Meese, back on the program for the third time. As previously introduced, Jeannie is the founder and executive director of Agano with Kenya and executive director of Cradle to Career Kenya, an organization established outside of Nairobi, Kenya, a nonprofit organization established to support and educate Kenyan orphans and vulnerable children from preschool through college to career. Note that connection. It follows all the way through in this support intervention. In turn, these educated, largely they're women, they will pay it forward to the next generation in their community. Previously, Jeannie Meese served on the board of directors of African Child Foundation, and her background includes 20 years in corporate sales and marketing. She received her Bachelor of Arts at Colgate University in International Relations and Economics. She is the mother of two children here in Orange County. Jeannie Meese found new purpose as she's forged a special relationship with Father Henry Samaro. And Father Henry himself, as he's often referred, was born and raised in Kenya and had come to know hundreds of orphans and other vulnerable children left behind from the scourge of AIDS and extreme poverty in Kenya. Today, my guest Jeannie Meese talks with us here in Studio A about the continuation of her extraordinary collaboration with Father Henry, the focus which will eventually be here on the program, the upcoming speaker series, 4 Evenings in May. Welcome back to the show, Jeannie.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Well, let's just start out by telling those who've not heard you on the show before what Cradle to Career Kenya is that you've developed now over just the last 2.5 years.
Thank you. You know, what we are doing is following the vision that Father Henry started in Kenya back in 2006. And he graduated with a master's degree at USC here in Southern California, went back to Kenya, and was devastated by all the orphans left behind for the funerals he was giving for the AIDS people that were dying from AIDS. So he started an orphanage and found that he needed to educate these orphans. And then he found that the other children wouldn't come to an orphan school. So he took it to the next step, found caregivers for each of these orphans, and then opened a school right there in the slums of Athi River, and all the orphans came back along with all the rest of the extremely poor children. And that's how he began his education program. We've since grown to opening a middle school, boarding school. What he was finding is they were getting an excellent education under his tutelage. But once they were going to overcrowded government schools with 90 children to a classroom, they weren't able to get through middle school and get into high school. So we opened a middle school, educated these poor and orphan children. And now the middle school is ranked number one out of 53 schools in academic performance in the Machakos County of Kenya. So these kids are getting the best education possible, and we have 100% graduation rate to high school. So they're going to, in Kenya, you go to boarding school. It's built on the British system. So we've got 100% attrition rate to high school. And now we've got 18 girls in college, and we've got six more that have been accepted into universities as soon as we can get the funding.
And we're gonna,
We're
going to go into some of those sort of success stories in a bit, but it's a general sort of an explanation, a narrative for those who are new. Okay. Newly exposed. So with that, so you're talking about the infrastructure, it's the existing house, the existing school that Father Henry set up, and then Mount Olive Academy, which largely your fundraiser stateside are about putting that entire facility together, which is residential and educational and, I don't know, cultural components, to all put together a place for the ever-expanding demographic that's lining up there. Jeannie, before we get into the examples of these major success stories that are already paying it forward, I'd like to know, how do you deal with this, the tremendous demand with your limited supply of spaces there in the program?
Oh, that's a very good question. And you know, we can't save the world, and we can't save every Kenyan child, but what we believe is that the children that get into our program, they're with us, and we're going to stick with them till they graduate from college. So the ones we do save, and we've touched at this point over the last 9 years, over 900, close to 1,000 children.
Wow.
And so what we've got to focus on is the ones we do touch. We don't just touch them and then leave them on their own. We stick with them until they're self-sufficient, productive people of society.
And as you mentioned before, the part of the charter here is to attend to the child bride issue, with where the orphans are in peril of an early marriage, and where they're not able to realize their larger potential as an individual contributing to Kenyan society. So it's you're really equipping them. So jumping in, intervening, so they have much more.
Especially if they don't have parents, their extended family are looking for a bride price. And so if they're in school, they are not being put into an early marriage. And if they're in school, and if they're in boarding school, which is, I think, important,
yes,
they're not susceptible to becoming pregnant.
Well, so then we're talking about how many, you say up to 1,000. So how many, let's talk about, in general, where they're headed. They've enrolled in the best universities around Nairobi, largely right in Nairobi, correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so let's talk about some of those women. You've had some nice interviews in the local press over the last week while Father Henry was here visiting, raising awareness, raising funds. So if you could give us a general trend of what they're heading into, or if there's general career patterns, vocations, or something like that, and what the kind of reaction they're getting when they come back and sort of work the school crowd kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, if you talk to any of the elementary school children, basically by fourth grade, if they're still in school, they're going to stick with it. And those are the ones that we want to help find their way. By the time they're in middle school, every single one of them want to be a doctor. What do you want to be when you grow up? A doctor. So you, you're just proud that they have such high ambitions. When they go off to boarding school, we're really letting them go and figure themselves out. They're not under Father Henry's domain. They're going to separate boarding schools. And then, they're boarding schools all over Kenya. And then when it's time for college, we have girls in, well, we actually had one that did get a full ride for medicine at University of Nairobi. We've got another one who's in med school at Egerton, which is in northern Kenya. We've got six girls at Strathmore University, which was one of the top universities on the continent of Kenya. And that's mainly a business university. And then we've got a number of girls in law school at Catholic University in Nairobi. So they're going in all different directions. Luckily, they're not every single one of them going to be a doctor.
Okay.
Because the country needs more than doctors.
Well, it's a credit to your organization how in your chart, I'm going to quote it all because it captures, as the charter says, and I quote it word for word, there will be a day when the supporters of Cradle to Career will sit on the advisory boards for the organizations in Kenya that our college graduates begin. We will attend the election parties when our students win seats in Parliament. Cradle to Career is a U.S. organization with a model to help children in a country that does not have a strong social service network, but Cradle to Career's business model also includes a plan to phase out our work. The children we are educating today are the young adults who are touching others in their country at a geometrically progressive rate as they help their own. Our job decreases. So you're easing out and they're taking over in terms of promoting this intervention that's ongoing there at Cradle to Career, as well as filling in business, legal, and medical kinds of positions to improve that social safety network that's you've found so many large holes.
You know what, Claudia, that's absolutely right. And you know what, they're following the lead of Father Henry. He was a street child or a village child and was rescued and educated. It's all about education and giving back.
That's He's the first contract. He's been paying it forward.
Exactly.
By the thousandfold.
Yeah, and that's what our children are doing. We can't change or do anything for Kenya. They've got to do it themselves. But we can give them the tools of education so that they can take over Parliament and they can take over the society to make it to improve their lot. And I cannot wait till I'm sitting on their boards, you know.
Right, yeah. Right. Well, there's some specific ones in your interviews that you talked about, so-called case studies of the women already making good.
Well, you know, I think one of them is Grace, and she's a beautiful young girl. She's studying IT. And part of the agreement, as you're going through our program, I mean, starting at the chores are like the old-fashioned days in America where you had to chop the wood in order to get your breakfast. I mean, these kids starting in preschool are helping give back to make the program work.
They're pitching in at the school?
Oh yeah. They're harvesting the gardens where we grow the food at Mount Olive. They're doing all the wash, you know, and they have to do it by hand in buckets. I've got some wonderful pictures of all the middle school girls out there in their buckets washing all the clothes. They do all the cleaning. And so they're constantly giving back. Once they get to college, we ask them to give back to their community.
Well, Jean, before you go into that, is there like a little sort of a school government there?
Oh, yeah.
So there's that kind of civil lesson they're getting too. Yeah. So that's another level dimension. Yeah. Good. Okay. Yeah. So back to what you're saying. Sorry.
One example I think of as Grace is all of them are doing some type of community service that they have to find on their own. Through Grace's church, she found a shelter for street children. And so she was working there about 6 hours a week while she was going to college and bonding with these little kids they picked up off the streets of the slum. And she was asking me for donations so that she could help them plant a garden and paint a mural. And I'm like, wait a second, you're the one who's mired in poverty and you're the one that is in need of help, and now you're fundraising.
She's paying it forward
for this next funding tiny generation.
Yeah. Wow.
And then she told me I don't think it's indigenous, indicative in something, I can't think of the word, in the Kenyan culture to give
emblematic
volunteer the way we do. Okay. And, I mean, we're always volunteering in our communities. And I do a yearly video interview with each of them to track what they're doing. And she said she didn't realize she could give back. So here's a girl that grew up in total poverty and now is taking a stand to help others that are even less fortunate than she is. So, I mean, it was just warmed my heart to see her do it, to see the bond she was making with these little kids, and to say, I'm making a difference in somebody else's life. That captured it all.
A heady message.
Yeah.
Wow. For the children to see that she's so empowered now that she's paying it forward.
And she's also the leader. She's turned out the leader of the college girls, and she's forever bossing them around.
How old is she?
She's 21.
Okay.
And I got together with them all in January, and she was like on one girl. You should not dress like that when you're meeting with Jeannie and we're all getting together. I want to see you dress better next time.
Now, you said her mother, so this is not an orphan. But
that's not an orphan.
She's in some, it was impoverished and vulnerable in that way.
Exactly.
So how did she qualify, though? Just because of that, her low economic status?
Yeah. I mean, she lives in the slums of Molongo, and Molongo is a pretty rough area. She would not have gone to high school, and she would not have, I've got a beautiful video of her saying her mom, because she does have a strong mom in this case, and her mom was teaching her how to be a hairdresser. So a hairdresser in the slum means, you know, you make pennies a day. And tears were in her eyes. She had such fierce ambition. And she did not want to be...
That's Grace, not her, and her mom. Probably
her mom is a hairdresser.
Okay.
Her mom's friends are hairdressers.
They both had hairdressers.
Yeah. But a hairdresser, again, it's not like going to a salon in Orange County.
Oh, I understand that. I'm just trying to make sure we know who's the driven one. But it's actually both of them
both
that
of
are
them.
Pretty driven.
Yeah.
So what's her area of interest then?
Oh, IT.
That's right.
And she's gonna do really big things, especially because there's a huge market growing in Kenya for information technology. It is growing.
Right. Oh, wait, from so. Rwanda going eastward to Kenya. Okay. Yeah. Wow. And so some other case studies. We for those of you who's just joined us, this is Ask a Leader on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest is Jeannie Meese, founder and executive director of Cradle to Career Kenya. And we're talking about those extraordinary individuals now who, with the benefit of this safe and thriving educational residential setting provided here in the Athi River outside of Nairobi, Kenya, are making an incredible difference. And so one or two other people before we talk about the important series of Thursday evenings coming up.
Mount Olive, the model is that 50% of the children come from paying families, paying people that can afford it. And then the other 50% come from our elementary school where there is zero money and they're in total poverty. And what we're finding is because the education is so strict in our elementary school that these slum children are actually outperforming the paying student that have applied to come into Mount Olive.
There's a structure that's sort of boosting them or what?
Yeah, it's called this? Father Henry and his...
Right.
But they have huge, the academics are pushed so hard. I mean, that's not to say they don't get to play and have fun.
Right, but there's a real structure, there's a real, it's an opportunity. They know this is it, this is the ticket. And
you
so
know,
it's a democratizing kind of
exactly.
regimen.
There's two things happening. First of all, I've got to say my own prejudice. For so long, I thought if you're poor, that means you weren't smart. And the intelligence in these little slum communities is mind-blowing.
Well, they've got to survive. There's nothing
like
street
smart,
intelligence.
And they're street smart on top of being intelligent. And they're testing very high on their scores, as indicative of Mount Olive being ranked number one out of 53 schools academically.
That's
in
incredible.
That district. So, you know, I think of Marianne. She's a beautiful singer. And, you know, I interviewed her. And, yeah, I want to go to Yale University. And I'm like, oh, isn't that sweet? But it turns out she came from Fanaka. She's in Mount Olive. And she scored top scores in order to get one of the more competitive boarding schools in Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
So she may just be on her way.
Okay.
To
How old is
really,
she?
She's just finished eighth grade.
Okay.
So she's starting high school right now. So
okay.
She'll leave Mount Olive and go off to a high school boarding school.
Okay.
So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, what we want to make sure everybody has plenty of information. It's the upcoming series beginning this Thursday, May 9th, which I understand it's about raising awareness, not so much as raising funds, but I'm sure you do pass the hat. So change is welcome. So that's four different Thursday evenings in May. And the speaking schedule, you're going to first start with as I said, May 9th, sponsor child to PhD, and that will be at a residence in Shady Canyon. So what would you like to say about that, the lead-off lecture?
Well, Edith claims she's our poster child. She was a sponsor child in Kenya, and you know, it touched my heart when I was talking to her. She spoke at a previous time because she said, you know what? There was a group at the YMCA in Germany that sponsored my high school education.
Really?
I can never find them to thank them. I don't know who they are. But they allowed her to get through high school. She did not have the funds. And she would be on the streets today. And she's not on the streets. She went on to get her graduate work and... I mean, to make a long story short, she's a PhD. She's a professor at UCLA in education. And I actually audited one of her classes last year. And she's also a fabulous speaker. You're sitting on the edge of your seat because she's very opinionated and very strong. And I think it's interesting. She has a middle school child that she sent back to Kenya for her education. And that tells you something about where her beliefs are and how strongly she feels about...
two things, for her child and for Kenyan society.
Raised
the whole bar for everybody with her aspirations through that child.
Exactly.
That's the first one. Then the second is May 16th, honoring women in African arts. That's at Sage Hill School. We'll talk about access and contact information, but we're going to go first through each of the talks. So tell us what's in store for that art.
This is really exciting. Polly Roberts is the curator for African arts at LACMA, Los Angeles County Museum of Art. She's also a professor at UCLA. And LACMA is actually opening a new African arts gallery in July. And she has been the one spearheading this move towards focusing on African arts. They just made a $1 million purchase of a piece from Mali that's one of the oldest pieces of its kind. She has a wealth of knowledge. She's well-respected around the world, and I just cannot wait to hear what she has to say.
And you have, and it's at her, and is there somebody affiliated with the... Cradle to Career, who's going to be appearing, or that's okay. That's separate. So, that May 23rd,
I'll be appearing.
You'll be, of course. No, I wasn't sure if somebody's going to be paying it over here and May 23rd, I seem to think I've got three here, but there's a fourth one. But May 23rd is teaching in Kibera, Africa's largest slum.
That is fascinating. Nancy Langton. Is a professor at University of British Columbia and each year goes over to Nairobi for a 6 weeks business class in Kibera, the largest slum, helping people write business plans so that they can be basically mini entrepreneurs. I spent a couple days with her, took about 200 pictures, 2,000, I don't know which one, of life in Kibera. And we'll be showing those slides and showing what going to a shoe store in Kibera. I mean, you just think of a slum as a slum, but it's a little city unto itself.
How far is it from Nairobi?
It's right in Nairobi. There's a million inhabitants in the slum, right inside the city limits.
Okay. Wow. So that's the third engagement.
One.
Yeah. And then the final one
is May 30th. Leon Tomasian this is a fascinating story. I don't want to tell it because it is so interesting, but he grew up in Kenya during the colonial age. And his whole story, so he's coming at the talking about a different world that was Kenya in those days under the British influence. The way he got there, his father was part of the Armenian genocide, then all the way down there. So it is a fascinating story. And then to hear about what Kenya was like to a 6, 7, 8, he lived there till he was 18, during that colonial
Armenian
days.
Colonial. Wow, that's a lot of displacement.
Yeah, exactly.
So he'll have a lot of context. And that is going to be which location?
May 30th. That'll be at a home in Newport.
Another home. Okay, so folks, you're wondering, now, besides, where did you put the pen and paper down? We suggest that you get a hold. You go on the website for the organization. It's c2ckenya.org. And there you will find each of those speaking series installments, and you can find out by clicking on each individual one. You'll sign up yourself, and then you'll get the privileged location information, how to go to some of these. Largely, there, 3 out of 4 of them are at private homes. Mm-hmm. And Sage Hill, there isn't any kind of restricted kind of access that way, but they are counting those. So it's a way of you RSVPing when you sign in. So c2ckenya.org. You can also reach Jeannie at jeannie.meece@c2ckenya.org. There's also a phone number, 949-533-9569, so that you can find out where, when, how, a few more details, but Jeannie's expanded a little bit more here than is actually in the on the website. So it's not to, also not to forget, those you can also put on your calendar later on this year is going to be their gala fundraiser planned for for September 20th, sunset on the Serengeti. So there's I know it's bling, it's in Newport Beach, but it's this is really about learning and a riveting experience and about purpose. And it's, you can assure the listeners that attending a gala isn't about feeling like you're rubbing shoulders, but you're really greasing palms.
Right, exactly.
So it's a different sensibility that in terms of what we might associate with galas. So it's been a real pleasure having Jeannie Meese on today on Ask a Leader. I wish you well. I'm looking forward to getting in as many of these talks as I can, but space is going to be limited. So mm-hmm. It's important for people to get a hold of the website, c2ckenya.org, to sign up, because, I mean, what's some of the smallest capacities are, what, upward of 50 people might fill it up?
That's pushing it. That's pushing
okay,
it.
Okay, yeah. So...
Can I say one thing?
Absolutely, Jeannie Meese.
C2C, it's the lower letter C, the number 2, and the letter C.
That's what I...
Kenya.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So, or if you go Cradle to Career Kenya, then it'll send up the actual one. Are you searching for this? And that you'll get on your way. And so I'm so glad that Jeannie Meese could come back, and she would no doubt be around for... further installments on what this contract paying it forward is, and how Father Henry is progressing with you're progressing with school. You get there. How many times a year do you make it over to the
Athi River. I was there twice, every 6 months, but it depends, 6 to 12 months.
Okay.
Once a year, sometimes twice a year.
So this is not like a remote control, and Jeannie gets in there. She can get in a little... A gorilla trekking while she's up there, but she's really really familiar with the territory and making a really impressive inroad with that as a woman of many means and talents here in the Newport Beach community. So, Jeannie Meese, I really thank you so much for being on Ask a Leader once again.
Thank you.
All the best to you.
Thanks so much.
Well, we're going to have a short break here, and then we'll bring on Phyllis Lugin, who's going to be our art maven to cover the art world within our very midst. So don't go away. We will be right back. Thank you, everybody, for joining and staying with us. This is back Ask a Leader here on 88.9 FM in Irvine. My next guest is Phyllis Lujan. She is a museum professional for over 50 years. Phyllis has worked at the Art Institute of Chicago, the San Francisco Museum of Art, the Esther Robles Gallery, Los Angeles, the Earl Carter Gallery, Los Angeles, Newport Harbor Museum, Orange County Museum of Art now, and the TLK Gallery, Turnbull Lujan Kogan, where you recognize Phyllis's name amidst that group. Along with her appointments as the museum scientist at the University of California, Irvine, Phyllis taught a museum problems course in the School of Fine Arts. Since her retirement in 1992, she conducts nearly monthly seminars known as the Art Crowd, which in her words is, quote, an archaic name for a non-archaic people, bringing lecturers, artists, curators, art critics, art historians, and artists from Orange County and Los Angeles area to her home to discuss art. End of quote there. As she does in that setting, she is here today to help all of us develop an understanding of the intricate machinations of the art world. So, just what an art maven does with her wealth of experience and knowledge, she joins me here this morning in Studio A. Welcome to the program. Phil, you can come really close to that mic, just practically kissing it.
Thank you so much. After that introduction, you must think I'm 100 years old, but I'm really only 83. So I've had enough experience to not only take art very seriously, but also to know that there can be a lot of edginess and humor in the aspects of the art world. What I wanted to start off with today was just a few quotes that I had, and I'm sorry to say I do not know who these quotes are from. I've had them for many years, and I believe that I'd like to read just a couple of them. The first one is, if modern art makes us react engaged or enraged, I should say, it is because of what is at stake, the capacity to make sense of life as it is presented. And the next one I'd like to read is, art gives us reassurance without language that we are at home in a world with each other.
Oh, that is a whole sigh of relief, a pause to linger with for another couple of hours. That's exactly how I feel when I've really connected with a string of pieces in any gallery. That's beautiful, Phyllis.
And that's how it should be. And then this is the last one. When art is made new, we are made new with it. Mm. We have a sense of solidarity with our own time and of psychic energy shared and redoubled, which is just about the most satisfying thing life has to offer. We say to ourselves, if this is possible, everything is possible, and a phase in the history of human awareness has been opened. And art has, you know, many, many meanings to each one of us, and it's all relative to what we think. Art can be beautiful decorative pieces. They hang on the wall. We love to look at them. We enjoy them. They can have an art historical context. They can have just simply a creative process for which we can explore, even though we don't consider ourselves artists. And so for me, these three quotes or so have tremendous meaning.
They do for all of us. I'm just really delighted to hear you start off with that. It puts us in a mood and puts us all on the same sort of a wavelength about we're all eligible, we're all qualified to walk into that gallery, to walk into that performance and experience that. And when you're saying art, I'm sure you're even including not just graphic, but performing arts as well.
Yes, I am. And the whole point of my career, when I started being curator of education and performance art at what is now the Orange County Museum, and this was like 1,000 years ago. It was when it was the Newport Harbor Art Museum, and we were located in the Balboa Pavilion. I'm talking 40 years ago. But I have always felt that art history is a very important part of art, but it is not art itself. And one of the questions I like to ask people who are in the professional aspects of contemporary art is this question.
Yes.
Is art about art history, or is art history about art?
I heard that coming. Oh, wow.
And that's a very profound question, because when you talk to academics, they are so interested in placing art into these categories. And that produces a cultural history of the world, actually, from the cave paintings on. But for me, and I speak very personally,
yes,
art is a revelatory experience for the individual person. And when I go into art museums, whether they're small museums or whether they're large museums, and I see these labels on the walls, and we've all have seen them, and we see people walking around with earphones on, being told what the paintings are about, the explanation of the art history. That's all wonderful. That's all good. And I have to say that, and I want to say that, because after all, I was curator of education.
Mm-hmm.
But I get a lot of flack from my colleagues because of my belief that art is still a one-on-one experience. And when a person walks into a museum and starts reading those labels on the wall and interprets the art they see through those labels, it takes away their own personal experience. And for me, it doesn't matter whether you love the work of art or you hate the work of art. That's irrelevant, but that you have that experience. Now, I know that...
Well, Phyllis, while we're talking about that label, sometimes I worry the more extensive, the more protracted a detail on the label, the less I'm actually working on looking at the art. There's a hazard here.
That's absolutely true. We've all seen this. We've done it ourselves.
Right.
We've seen people spend maybe a half a minute reading a very long label on the wall and then taking about 4 seconds to look at the art.
It's true. I know that. I think about that. I see myself do that.
And you just go on and you go on.
Revelatory kind of experience you're talking about might be at real risk there.
It absolutely is at risk. And I think that... that to see people in the galleries walking like that, it is not that I'm against art history at all. This is my approach.
Yes.
Go in, have your experience, and then if you want to know more about the art, you can go in and there is a ton of information that you can read. There's libraries there. Go back and read the labels, and then you can say to yourself, oh my goodness, I never thought of that. I'm going to go back and take another look. But at least you've had your own experience.
First.
And the art history and explanation can come again and enhance your own experience.
Okay.
That's what I believe.
That's wonderful. I just can't help leave the punchline alone that I have come up with, that the purpose of the headphones, although I use them from time to time myself, but I joke that they're intended to help the person block. They give instructions to the wearer how to block the people behind them without the headphones.
Oh, that's
a little further to the left. No, a little bit back again. Now you've blocked 6 people. So
it's very fascinating. But I can remember, this is a hilarious story. I was in the Tate Gallery with my daughter. She was about 18.
In Chicago, no?
No, in London.
Or London, I'm sorry.
Yes, that's right.
That's yes.
Okay. It doesn't matter. I was in London at the Tate Gallery, and I was with my daughter. She was 18 at the time, and she's 53 now. Oh my goodness, I say. Rachel, how can you be 53 when I'm only 53? The point being, though, we were in the Tate, and we were walking around, and there was an Ad Reinhardt painting, and Ad Reinhardt does, quote, black paintings, hypothetically, black paintings. We were walking around looking in the contemporary gallery, and as I walked by a young couple, I heard the gentleman say, oh, another black painting, and he walked on.
Oh.
So I turned to my daughter, and I said, excuse me, sweetheart, I have to take care of this. And my daughter said, I'm out of here, Mom. And so I walked over to the gentleman, I tapped him on the shoulder, and I said, would you be just kind enough, please, to just go over and look at that black painting? I couldn't help, I heard you mention that.
Oh,
and,
Maven work coming up.
He looked at me, and he said, certainly. So I walked on, I went into, they had these beautiful abstract Mark Rothkos in the next gallery. And I was there for maybe 3 or 4 minutes sitting on a bench looking at the Rothkos. And this man came up to me again and he tapped me on the shoulder. And he said, thank you so much. And the reason he said thank you is because if anyone stands in front of a black painting by Ad Reinhardt, you will see this cross form very gently appear that floats in front of that painting. And it's not an optical illusion. It is an object for meditation and contemplation. And it can, if you give it time, take you into the infinity. And so these minimal artworks often, not always, but often take you into a place that you did not know that you had in yourself.
In yourself. And I'm just going to, I think my problem with the Tate is it sounds a little like Chase. And Chase, there's a Chase Auditorium in Chicago.
Yes.
So I'm going to plea an alliterative mea culpa there. So this is what you're about then. You're helping us demystify for all time, all kinds of art, but especially demystifying contemporary art, which is the art being made in our time, the art that is now newly made in terms of newly created, new reputations established, and these are the people that we have an opportunity to connect with while they're around, and we can perhaps even afford them because they haven't launched a huge reputation. So let us in on, you talked a little bit about some this abstract art, but more about how we can demystify contemporary art that's all around us.
Well, I think that, first of all, any person that goes into a museum, or I should say most often, people who go to museums are seeking for something. They're seeking for something, perhaps something within themselves. And I think that if you can open up your own personal definition of what you think art must be, not what art is, because that's still in a lot of contention right now.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But what your definition of art is, if you can open that up, and if you want to open that up, that will open up your interest in going into an art museum and walking into the contemporary art galleries. How many people will walk by a contemporary art gallery, look in there and go, ugh, and just make a sound of absolute disgust? Now, the thing is this. I have been accused of liking contemporary art, all contemporary art, and I will say I do not like all of contemporary art. But for me, it is a way in which I can see how the mind operates, where the mind can creatively take an artist. And that is what intrigues me. For example, the Richard Jackson Show, which is at the Orange County Museum, that is a show that can open up a person's mind. It does not matter whether you like it or not, but he is working on major issues of not only art history, but how the commercial aspects of art relate to the individual. And it's an opening of your mind. And if it's closed, I feel that you are missing a tremendous experience, because art, again, for me, is for the soul. It is opening an awareness that we did not know we had.
Maybe it's an analogy is it's learning how to take deeper breaths culturally.
Yes, that's exactly true, and not close off your breath so that you cannot breathe.
Not a shallow breath, but a deep one.
A very deep one.
Attunement.
Yes.
Oh. And for those of you joining us, my guest in this portion of the show is Phyllis Lejean, and she is our art maven today here on Ask a Leader. It's 88.9 FM in Irvine, streaming all over galleries all over the world on KUCI.org. And we have a raft of opportunities. Now, I think the Richard Jackson show is completed, and then there's it's a month or so of they're getting up their next exhibit. So if we missed Richard Jackson, we're gonna have to figure out how to get to that. But it's been a real sensation. So we're gonna cover some there's there's artwork that can be enjoyed right here at UCI. There's the University Gallery. I'm looking at my notes here. We've got
Yes. Let me interrupt you.
Oh, please.
Okay. When I moved to Orange County, UCI had two buildings, maybe three.
Okay.
The
this
fine
is what
art,
mavens do.
Yeah. This was in 1968. That's how long I've been in Orange County. And the art community in Orange County in 1968 was minuscule, but it was there. We did have the Newport Harbor Art Museum, which is now the Orange County Museum of Art, that was located in the Balboa Pavilion. And in those days, we were doing such shows as The Appearing, Disappearing Image Object, where Michael Asher, who's now passed on, did an invisible door. Now, we're talking 1968 Orange County.
When Yoko Ono was putting nails and things like that in New
York.
Okay.
Absolutely. But this is Orange County, the second floor of the Balboa Pavilion, if you can imagine that.
Wow.
Tom Garver, when we moved to Balboa, did a show called the San Francisco Performance. Lots of performance art. It was an incredible museum. That museum has a tremendous history. But UCI did have the Fine Arts Gallery at that time. The community wasn't the way it is now. You have in Santa Ana, you have so many art organizations. You have
collect yourself the thought about that. I just want
The Orange County Center for Contemporary Art.
Oh, right. I just call it the OCCCC.
That's right, exactly.
Yes.
They've been going on since 1980, and they are, it's a tremendous surge there. That whole complex in downtown Santa Ana, you have the Santora building where there's a ton of galleries, and also Cal State Fullerton has Grand Central Center with Grand Central Station. John Spiak, I think, is his name, that runs it. He's fabulous. He's doing so many things to bring people into the gallery, into that space. The Orange County Center for Contemporary Art is kind of a co-op, but they've been going strong now there since 1980. You then have the Irvine Fine Arts Center, where Carl Berg, coming out of Los Angeles, he had a gallery in L.A., who's bringing contemporary art to the Irvine Fine Arts Center, and they have incredible classes there. And all of these things together with the Laguna Art Museum, with their lovely new curator, she's been there a couple of years, Grace Cook Anderson, who's bringing in new shows. So there is a huge thrust in this area to inform people and to seduce people, really, into the joys of contemporary art.
Very fine. And we really do want to make sure we can pitch the opportunities right around the corner from the studio. There's all these are the artists on their way up, the Masters of Fine Arts candidates, their theses exhibitions, part one, will be ending at the end of this week, and part two will be scheduled for May 16th to 31st. That's at UCI's Contemporary Arts Center, the University Art Gallery, and the Room Gallery, and the Honors Exhibition for UCI's students. It's from June 6th to the 14th, and you can always get information at the UCIGallery.com. And there's a thought that you just recalled, and I want you to be sure, Phyllis, to bring that in.
Right. The thought is that I don't want to forget the Beale Center for the Art Sciences and
But they're done for the year.
They are done for
They're done for the year, but the BEALL, and you can find them also on the UCIGallery.com website. But they have extraordinary, it's a real coup for so many of those exhibits and installations there from all over the world, and they make a point of bringing whole families in for some very tactile, kinesthetic sorts of experiences in there. And I'm always changed by what's been, you're just walking amidst the whole installation. You're part of the performance art, in a sense.
Right. The thing, too, is that what I've noticed lately is that many of the museums in the area and art organizations in the area are seducing the parents of children to come to the museums and to the galleries. They offer art opportunities for youngsters, and they figure, and rightly so, bring in the children, let them have a good time, and then seduce the parents. And I think that's a fabulous idea. I've noticed that the Laguna Art Museum had a number of things for children.
They all do it because they know they've got to get that patronage started at an early age. It's not just about commercial imprinting, but the cultural imprinting. It's so, so important. And we've talked about all the major museums and other shows, so I didn't think we need to give them lip service. Jeffrey Frisch with the OCCCCCCA has been on, so we've had a chance to talk about that. But it certainly is an important agglomeration of the fine arts all around in that part of Santa Ana. So it's a really vibrant center. Now, I want to quickly close with you talking about your salon, the Art Crowds. As we said, it's an archaic name for non-archaic people that you host. And for people who would like some information, I'm going to put it on the podcast, but we'll talk a little bit about that now, where people can be a part of that.
Well, when I left UCI, that was in 1992, a long time ago. I can't believe it myself. I didn't want to just completely eliminate myself, you know, from the art world. It was a part of my life for so many years. And someone suggested, we were sitting in my living, someone suggested, well, Phyllis, why don't you do some kind of a salon? And I thought, that might sound interesting. So I put together my very first salon in November of 1992. And Frank Dixon, who is a artist who lives in Santa Ana, he's absolutely brilliant, was my first speaker.
Wow.
And I serve a breakfast that I conjure up in my kitchen. My house is not very large, so people are sitting on the floor and up the staircase. I charge a courtesy fee. I invite a speaker, and we talk art on Saturday mornings from 9:30 to around noon. And the next one is coming up on Saturday. We will be visiting Frank Dixon's studio in Santa Ana.
The Art Architecture Digital Computer Collaboration.
That's
title.
Right. It's a collaboration between Frank Dixon and Daniela Folletto. They are collaborating on work using the digital media as their media. And the difference between them collaborating together without original artwork is that they are using original artwork from their own bodies of work,
okay,
putting them on the computer and arbitrarily using other works on the computer and making these large artworks that are printed through a glissé media, and they look exactly like paintings. They are not paintings. They are perhaps better described as prints or etchings, a reproducible media. And there's a very fine line here about, again, what the definitions of art might be. And so, at any rate, I'm doing that because we're going to be discussing those issues, and he's having the printmaker there, and we're going to be able to see how these things are actually developed and
made. Oh, really?
Made.
That's great. And I know people want to know how they're going to be able to get their reservation for Saturday.
Yes.
And how they're going to find out about the one, if they can't make it to Saturday, the one in the next 5 weeks or so.
Yes. My email address, let me give that, is artcrowd, artcrowd, @ cox.net, and ArtCrowd is one word, all small letters, of course. And I have been doing this, but I've had some major people. I've had Paul Schimmel come to speak. I've had Christopher Knight, the LA Times critic, speak. I've had George Herms, the pioneer assemblage artist, speak. I've had Larry Pittman come and speak. Lynn Folks, who...
They're all listed on your website.
Right.
All of them. It's just a really illustrious set. And if people don't know those names, that's where we start, where we are, and we find out who they are, and find out our contemporaries who would be a part of the salon at a later date.
Absolutely. And I've had fun doing it. And the thing about it that people have asked me, oh, do it in a museum. I say no, because it's so informal, and that my guests that come are on a one-to-one basis with these people. And that's what makes it interesting. And it's always a discussion. It is not a student-mentor situation. It is a discussion where ideas are brought up. And that's what makes it interesting for me and my guests that come.
Well, I know that we have a lot more to cover, and it is, unfortunately, we have a limit of time, but I think, Phyllis, you have gone a long way to launch us onto a deeper appreciation of the fine arts around us and an appreciation of what we're capable. So I really, really want to thank you for bringing the heft of your deep cultural engagement with the fine arts and producing institutions around you and including us in those. And I want to thank you so much.
Can I just say
one more thing? Right, indeed.
One last thing.
Yes.
This is a quote from Albert Einstein in connection with art and art history. "It is a miracle curiosity survives formal education." Albert Einstein.
Oh, right. It is. Well, thank you so much, art maven Phyllis Lujan. We're going to close this. I've got a few remarks to make, but I'm going to close it right now with a little, let's see, we're going to get that or not here. What I'm going to do is mention that, speaking of the Fine Arts Center, and I'm going to ask Jorge Rosales to give me a few more minutes. I hate to say I'm winning way the heck over today, but speaking of the cultural offerings in Irvine, the Fine Arts Center is the location for where some Uni High students are asking for additional support of their work that helps bring in some more funding to their program there. The two Uni Arts artists, they're currently one of 50 finalist schools here at the Vans Custom Cultural Shoe Design Contest, and they need to win the public vote in order to make it to the finals in New York City with the chance to win, listen in, $50,000 for the school art department. So the budget cuts, they said, were pretty tough, so this kind of money can go huge direction into helping that out. And so that is going on. The work is displayed at the Cultural Arts Center. I'm going to mention the three steps that can be taken to support those students. There's the website vans.com/custom-culture/vote. So you select the California region, then you select University High School. So what we're also going to do is closing out here. I wanted to well, there's a couple things. I'm going to go way the heck over. Sorry, Jorge. With Mother's Day just around the corner, I'd like to remind everyone we meant everything we said about it last year. A 40-something perspective, 50-something perspective, and a 70-something perspective. Enjoy the podcast. I entitled it Sisters and Mothers. It's May 8, 2012. Thanks, everyone who supported the KUCI fund drive during the last couple weeks, and for everyone who's at the cusp of joining those generous supports by sending in your contribution. Well, that's all the time I have on Ask a Leader, but I do want to tell you next week, we're going to talk to the two teachers that are helping out with a 1,000 Words exhibit. That's Hallie Kessler and Dana Kramer, and then I'm going to have the treat of live from Brooklyn, we're going to hear from author-illustrator Ricardo Cortez to talk about his latest book, listen in, A Secret History of Coffee, Coca, and Cola. Next up is Jorge Rosales with George Hat. Talk with you next week. Thank you so much for listening.